Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Denise Michaud with the Club's Grownups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Regina Sneed is a longtime supporter and member of Compassion and Choices, the nation's oldest and largest nonprofit organization working to improve care and expanded choice at the end of life through support of individuals and families, education, and advocacy at the local and national levels. She retired with 30 years of federal government service, working in the fields of consumer protection, civil rights, and education. She has been active with environmental and human rights organizations in San Francisco and internationally. She enjoys an active cultural life as a San Francisco Museum of Modern Art guide and supporter and volunteer for contemporary music, dance, and theater. Please welcome Virginia Sneed.
Well, good afternoon. It's a delight to be here. I'm a proud member of the Commonwealth Club, and this is sort of like my bucket list, right? I get to check off that I spoke here. It's kind of cool. So thank you very much for coming. I want to start out, and since it's the end of the work day, everybody just take a deep breath in and out. And just let go of all of your cares about the work day. And let go any anxieties you may have had about talking about dying, okay? And now I'm going to read a little haiku by Kozan Ishikyo. Empty-handed, I entered the world. Barefoot, I leave it. My coming, my going, two simple happenings that got entangled. Got to start with a poem, right? And now I want to share a little bit about what we're going to do. I collected up some information from you when you came in, so I'm going to share that first so everybody could be anonymous and say the real reason they came, and we'll kind of know that. And we'll also kind of know who's out there and what resources we might have for our discussion a little later on. Then I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I got involved in the issue and go through some of the kind of issues to find out where you are on this path, how much have you already done, and what is maybe remaining to be done. So I'm going to do a little census. You're going to raise your hands, and we're going to see how you stack up compared to other audiences I've spoken to. And then most of you are interested in knowing about the latest option for end-of-life choices, which is the new law that passed and went into effect in June in California. And so we're going to spend time talking about that and have plenty of time for you to be able to ask some questions about that. So this is a very lively Commonwealth Club group, and here are some of the reasons why people came. Most everybody's here to hear about end-of-life options. Somebody says, I want to be the captain of my own destiny. Somebody says, I don't want to worry my kids. I want to have this all done, planned. Somebody says, you know, I'm here because I still have all my marbles and I want to know what my options are. Some people have medical backgrounds here and have come to find out for their clients what the new laws are. We have some people in the audience who are either suffering from an illness that's terminal or have a friend who is and want to find out more about the new law that might have a direct impact on their lives. Some people want to die well. I think that's a pretty good reason to be here. Somebody just says, I'm 87. Somebody said, I'm 65. So these are all real good reasons to be here, and I'm very happy that everybody is here today and that we can talk about some of these issues. I also wanted to thank John Milford, who's the Grown-Ups Forum chair, who's not here with us tonight. I think he had another engagement. And Denise for coming and being our MC for tonight. That's really a pleasure to have been invited. So why I got involved in this issue. I want to start with I witnessed a good death. I was about 8 years old, and we were visiting my grandmother in the country, and I was taken over to another relative's house that had passed away to pay our respects. And my father says, please come into this room and see, you know, aunt, whatever. So I went in the room, and I found a person lying in bed under the covers. They looked very peaceful, and I was told that they were dead. So that was my first experience with death and dying. Now, I want to kind of give you my background on how maybe, you know, I got to the path of coming here. When I was in my 30s, I didn't think anything about this. When I was in my 40s, I finally got around to getting a will, but it was only one of those holographic wills. Does anybody know what that is? That's the cheap way of going in California. If you don't have a real will, you just get a piece of paper out, write your wishes down, sign your name and date it, no witnesses, and that's legal. So for a long time, I had one of those. And then a little bit later, when I grew up a little bit more, I decided I needed a real will and trusts and all that kind of stuff. So I did that financial piece, got that under control. And then I, because I was a federal employee, if some of you are former federal employees, you know we have this great long-term care insurance that was offered to us. So I signed up for that, and I do have that kind of a policy, which is kind of an interesting thing to have. And then, of course, I had got around to getting an advance directive for health care. So those are all kinds of things that I have put into place. But, you know, I'm 69. It took me a long time to get those done. And so I'm going to now find out where we all are on this path. So I'd like you to hold up your hand if you have a will. Pretty much almost everybody does, so that's pretty good. How many of you have an advance directive for health care? This group is better than average, about maybe, I would say, 80%. How many people have discussed their advanced health care directive with family members and friends? See, fewer or less of you. See, only about 40% have advanced care directives to begin with, but out of that 40%, only about 30% have actually talked to anybody about it. Now, how many people have talked to their doctor about their advanced care directive? See, even fewer of you. And how many people know where your advanced care directive is in your electronic medical record? A few people. That's good. You must be Kaiser patients, right? No, not Kaiser patients. Okay. That's important to know where, you know, that document is, and for your person to know where, you know, have a copy, but also to know that it's available. If you're found, if something happens to you and you're not in your usual medical setting, that might be really important to know. So those are kind of basic documents that one would need to have, that we would want to know about. I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that kind of lead up to our discussion about the new option, which is the End of Life Choices Act. So let me talk a little bit about some things that I'm going to actually steal from a book, which you can get from Compassion and Choices, called Your Life, Your Priorities, Options for Managing End-of-Life Decisions. And I'll tell you later. But I'm going to take a little time just to read some of these very quickly, because I think a lot of people came kind of wanting to know, well, what is the process? What is the plan that I might need to embark on? And what are some of the values that are important to that planning thing? So, and some people mentioned these when they came in. So I think they reflect back some of the issues that you're interested in. One is focus. These are kind of the seven principles for patient-centered end-of-life care. So end-of-life care should really focus on the individual's comfort. Often, when we're getting treatment by our doctors, as we start dying, they kind of withdraw because they become quite attached to you as a patient sometimes. So you have to be very careful, and you want to be in charge of your own care, and you want to set your own priorities for this process. And that's going to take some planning. The second one is self-determination, which is really about individual tolerance for pain and suffering. This can be really different between different people. So some people may be suffering too much, and your doctor needs to know about that. There are rules that apply now, I think, and maybe somebody can talk about it a little later, about somebody, you go in the hospital and they say, how much pain are you in, 1 to 10? And doctors will be able to give you pain medication so that you don't have to be suffering. Well, this applies in a situation where you're dying, too. So you want to be in a situation where providers can generously prescribe medications for pain and for breathlessness, give patients control over that dose so that you're really in charge of that. So I think that's somewhat important. And the small little things that I didn't know, I'm just going to read this paragraph because this was kind of interesting to me. Symptoms like hiccups, nausea, diarrhea, itching, and fatigue can be oppressive and should be taken seriously by your healthcare providers. And so you have to speak up about them, and you may need to your person to speak up for you if you're no longer able to do that yourself. The third is autonomy. So several of you mentioned this. You want to be in control. You're tired of dealing with doctors. You want to be the person who is deciding what's good for you. And that's the right answer. Even really very ill people can maintain their ability to tell what they want. And they should be listened to, and this loved ones and caregivers and providers shouldn't really usurp that power from you. But you have to do that, and you also, this is where your advanced care directive comes in again, and your person, you really need to communicate very clearly what your desires are and what that document means to the person that makes those decisions on your behalf, because that might be important to your autonomy. If you're no longer able to speak for yourself, you're going to want to do that. And personal values, you really have the right to have your own belief systems recognized. Your providers and other people, the institutions that you're in, really shouldn't judge you for what your needs are. And this kind of goes into information about religious beliefs and options. There was a conference here that Institute on Aging had, and the first part of the one-day conference was 90 minutes panels of faith leaders. And I actually learned a lot of things that I did not know before about different religions. I just assumed, made some assumptions that weren't accurate. One about Hindu religion and karma. Maybe that's something the 60s generation would understand a little bit about. But I learned that if you were to make a decision to end your life early, that karmic chain of events might be broken. And so maybe that isn't appropriate if you're a Hindu. And that might be a barrier to using that end-of-life options. And then I thought to myself, well, if I believed in reincarnation and I, did this, would I come back as Archie or Mehitable? So one person knows who I'm talking about. Good, thank you. Those are characters. That's a cockroach and a cat in a book. The next category is informed consent. And that one's really important. And I like this. Some of our medical people might know what this means, BRAIN. It means benefits, risks, alternatives, insight, and doing nothing. So I like that. And this could apply to any medical decision that you make, even having to do with end-of-life choices or anything else. do you, when a doctor prescribes a new medication to you, do you actually ask, well, what's the benefit? You know, in this case, we would be asking things like, is this going to prolong my life? What are the side effects of it? How will it affect my quality of life? And are there any alternatives? Or should I just do nothing? And you have a right to do nothing if that's your choice. You have a right to refuse treatment, et cetera, and that's important. The next one is balance. And that really has to do with empowering to be making decisions on your own assessment between the quantity and the quality of your life. And this goes back to, I think, several people's concerns that, you know, I want to be in control. I want to be the one that says, I don't want another round of therapy. I would prefer to have a few more months of quality with my grandchildren or family members and not be going through a cycle of chemo or something. So that's important. And the final one on this list is notice. And this has to do with institutions and policies. And this is really important for the End of Life Options Act. If you happen to be in a medical system that wouldn't support that new option, you may have to go outside that system and find another set of doctors and providers. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. So those are some of the themes, I think, that we can get more into when we talk more about the issue of the End of Life Options Act. But I also wanted to share seven reasons that humans fear dying. These come from a 1961 paper in the Journal of Abnormal and Social Psychology. My death would cause grief to my relatives and friends. All my plans and projects would come to an end. The process of dying might be painful. I could no longer have any experiences. I would no longer be able to care for my dependents. I'm afraid of what might happen to me if there is a life after death. I'm afraid of what might happen to my body after I die. So these from 1960, people's fears that they were expressing, which are kind of interesting. So before I stop to go into the End of Life Options Act, does anybody have like a comment they might want to make at this point? Okay. How many people have heard about the End of Life Options Act? Okay, quite a few. And so, you know, did you follow the hearings on it, perhaps, when it was going through the legislature? Nobody did, huh? I think there's one person that did. It was an interesting legislative process. It started out, of course, you know, the law in Oregon passed in 1987 or something, when in fact, 89. And couple years later, there was an attempt to put a ballot measure on the ballot in 1990 or 91. That did not pass. And so then we had about 17 or 18 years of experience in Oregon. And it was decided by Compassion and Choices and other groups that they would put together a strategy that started with the legislative process, but they also had as plan B that they would go to the ballot, and they kind of made that as part of the package. So they went to the legislature. It went through a process. It did not get out of the health committee at the end of that year. And the governor had a special legislative session for transportation issues. And through some parliamentary maneuvering, this bill was reintroduced in this special session and had a whole other set of hearings, but it didn't have to go through that health committee. So it actually passed in a special session of the legislature, and the reason why the effective date was June 9th was the special session of the legislature had to close first, and the effective date of the law was 90 days after. So that didn't actually happen until March, even though the bill passed at the end of last year. And normally things go into effect January 1st. But that's the reason that that did not go into effect. Let me talk a little bit about compassion and choices. And this presentation is based on information that they put together. Their vision is that a society in which people receive state-of-the-art medical care and a full range of choices for dying in comfort, dignity, and control. So that includes shared decision-making with your doctors and patients, that every person gets the medical treatment that they choose, aligned with their own values and priorities, and that their people and their loved ones should be fully informed and supported by providers on their end-of-life options. So those are pretty good goals. And the organization has put together a lot of resources and materials, and I'll give you a handout, a fact sheet on the law that has the website where you can order other materials and look at videos, etc. How many have heard of Dr. Gawande and the Being Mortal? Oh, good. Frontline was just actually rebroadcasting it today at 1 o'clock. It was a bestseller book. And basically, you can look at that documentary on Frontline on a PBS, and you can get it online if you want to watch it. It's quite interesting. It's called Being Mortal, and it's Atul Gawande is the doctor's name. And he said, life is meaningful because it is a story, and in stories, endings matter. So that documentary really talks about, you see many patients that were end of life. You had a question?
Yeah, the doctor's name is Gawande.
Yeah, it's G, I'll spell it for Gawande. Okay, so how many of you would like to die at home? Anybody? You realize that most people don't, unless you really plan well, and that many people end up being hospitalized within the last year, month, sometimes week of their death. How many know what hospice is? Have you had anybody that you has been in hospice? Have you been there? Yeah, several people. That's important, too.
Yeah,
I will. You can have it anywhere. It's a service. It's a service. So most hospices are either for-profit or non-profit. Some of you may know the Zen Hospice in San Francisco. That's quite a well-known one. So it's a service. You could also be in a hospice suite at UCSF. There's one on top of the hospital where a friend of mine actually died. So hospice could be at your home. It could be in an institution somewhere, but it's a set of services. Yes, I'm going to cover that too. So we're going to talk about hospice and how that's really very important to this End of Life Option Act. So most of us want to be at home with our loved ones. We want to have our pain managed and discomfort managed. We want to have our spiritual needs met. And a lot of people said this. They wanted to avoid any kind of emotional devastation of their loved ones. So they want to spare, we all seem to want to spare our loved ones, which I think is wonderful. So what are the end-of-life options that are available? There are several that are available that are before we get to the End-of-Life Options Act. So this is a continuum of things that one could experience. All treatments and end-of-life interventions are possible. So we want to support everybody if they want to have a medical treatment, whatever their choice is. If you want to die in the ICU, Compassion and Choices would support those options and want your provider to support that. If you want to refuse medical treatment or unwanted medical treatment, you have a right to do that. And that is something that you want to cover probably in an advance directive for a lot of things that would be there. But anything that's done to your body, you should have control over, and you should get the care that you want in your end-of-life choices. And that could be all the care that you want, every possible treatment, if that's what you want. But if you want to limit your options because you want to have a quality of life and you don't want to have certain treatments, you have an absolute right for that to happen. The word palliative care and sedation come up. I think we have some people here who could probably define palliative care. Does anybody want to do that for me? Linda? Yeah, we need a microphone for her. Yeah, I'm going to let you. Yeah, you could tell a little bit about that. Well, it's on being taped, so it's care that refers to comfort care, non-curative care, symptoms management. It can be in conjunction with curative care, et cetera.
So you can just talk covered a little it. More. and what we look at it for our patients is comfort care. So it may be a patient that is not quite ready to transition to hospice, but they need comfort care to manage their symptoms, and that could be pain or other physical symptoms. And so I guess that about covers it, what you said. It may not be active therapy, and that's what we do at our hospital, but there may be some therapy to help promote comfort, whether it be stretching or mm-hmm. breathing exercises. It includes integrative therapy as well. So someone could be getting acupuncture, or they could be doing meditation, some other things that go with the comfort care.
And that could be spiritual and emotional care, right? Yeah. So, and palliative sedation is sort of another aspect of that. That might be when you go into a coma at the end of your life, and that could happen sometimes naturally. My cousin slipped into a coma when she was dying of metastatic breast cancer and was in a coma for about 4 weeks, just kind of naturally. But it also can happen by sedation, and that might happen if you're in a really devastating pain, et cetera, and your body's not ready to die. That could happen. If somebody had a question. Let's get your question on the...
Isn't one of the conditions of palliative care when no treatment, medical treatment, can be provided any longer? No,
that's something different. That's okay. Hospice. So you could be getting palliative care and still beginning chemo.
Okay.
Because that could deal with all of your other symptoms, pain and other kinds of things. Accurate? And there's a question in the back. We'll go ahead and take some questions.
So the formal definition of palliative care is pain and symptom management for individuals with serious or life-limiting conditions. It's appropriate at any age, at any stage of life or illness. And it also includes medical decision support. And I think that palliative care is often overlooked in helping people navigate the services that are available to them and the decisions that they might have to make or be overwhelmed in making when facing a serious illness. So it can happen actually a lot earlier than when you're terminal or when you find out that you're terminal.
Yeah, that's very good. And you could have some other illness that's a life-threatening illness that's not going to cause you to die, but you could have a pain. This kind of care as part of your treatment. And I think, actually, would you say this is somewhat true, that because of the end-of-life choices in Oregon and other places, that palliative care training for doctors and is becoming a little bit more widespread and understood than it had been in the past? Okay. Let me go over one other one that you might know that has been part of the law in many states, including California, and that's voluntary stopping eating and drinking. Has anybody had heard of that before? A few people. So before we had the end-of-life options choice in California, one of your choices might have been to stop eating and drinking. And that can be done in a setting where it's you might go into a coma after a while. It's usually done in hospice or palliative care settings. And so you're being monitored by a medical team while you're doing this. You would go into a coma. The coma could last maybe 3 to 6 days, and maybe the average time of dying might be 6 to 14 days. And while this is happening, your body produces natural endorphins, and so that that is kind of like a natural anesthetic. So you're not suffering when this is happening. I witnessed this with my cousin who died of metastatic breast cancer when she was 50. So she was in a hospice setting in her brother's home, and I was spending some time there being a caregiver. And I saw her go into a coma just in this cycle happen. Now, I wanted to read the governor's signing statement, because remember I had mentioned to you that there was some controversy over the passage of this act. And part of it was from religious institutions that just don't believe that this should be an option. And we know that we have a Jesuit governor who's also a Buddhist. So after much going back and forth about the law, and when we get into the specific provisions, I'll talk a little bit about how maybe some of those came in to be in the law. But I thought this was a really wonderful signing statement that he signed on October 5th. I do not know what I would do if I were dying in prolonged or excruciating pain. I am certain, however, that it would be a comfort to be able to consider the options afforded by this bill. And I won't deny the right to others. So he was standing aside, basically, from maybe his own personal beliefs about the law. And I think that was pretty good. And that, I think, reflected, I think he listened very carefully to the testimony. And if you want to see a wonderful hearing, that I spent a lot of time doing legislative stuff in my job. I have never been so impressed with the final hearing where the legislators were talking about whether or not they were going to support or oppose this legislation after having heard a whole second set of hearings and testimony in the special session. They were eloquent. People who were opposed to the bill were eloquent in talking about their reasons for why they weren't supporting it. People who were in support of the bill, it was so civil. And it was just an amazing thing. So you could listen to about 2 hours if you want to listen to that. And you get a real sense of what some of the arguments were, pro and con, for this, and why it's so amazing that it actually passed and that we have it. Let me get water for a minute. Okay. I want to define what medical aid in dying is under the law, so that you know what that is. Medical aid in dying is a safe and trusted medical practice in which a terminally ill, mentally capable person with a prognosis of 6 months or less to live has the option to request from their doctor a prescription for medication which they can choose to self-ingest to end unbearable suffering and die peacefully. So that's it in a nutshell. And now let's go. Who's eligible? What are some of the things you know?
Terminally ill,
diagnosis of 6 months, prognosis. What else? You have to do it yourself. How old do you have to be? 18. So anybody under the age of 18 is not eligible to take advantage of this. No emancipated minors. Nothing like that. It has to be somebody 18. And you have to be a California resident. And that's very easy to establish. It's not difficult. You get a driver's license, you sign a lease. So establishing residency to use this law is pretty easy. So 18 years or older, terminal ill with a 6-month diagnosis, capable of making medical decisions and a California residence. So what does capable of making medical decisions mean? Could you have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's and use of the law? Anybody say yes? Good. No, probably not. If you have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, that's not going to be possible. So you have to be pretty careful about that. We had mentioned advanced directives earlier, and Compassionate Choices actually has, and this would not apply to the End of Life Options Act now, but your advanced directive, because this is a separate law that is not covered by your advanced directive. But just while I'm thinking of it, there's an Alzheimer's kind of a supplement or a provision that one can add to your advanced directive that could charge your person with what you would want done in that situation. That does not apply to the End of Life Options Act. So, a physician must inform a person about their end of life care options. And that means if you're on Medicare, you can make an appointment with your doctor and have a discussion about all of your end of life options. And that's paid for. You must make two verbal requests. And that has to be to your doctor, not to a nurse, not to the front office person, not to anybody else. It must be to your doctor. So you have to make that verbal request two times. Your doctor needs to record that in your records. And then you're going to have to make one written request later on. You're going to have two doctors that confirm your eligibility. And so, what if if one of those doctors thinks maybe your mental health isn't so good or you have a history of mental health? So you may be actually referred to a mental health professional for screening. Those people are going to make a distinction between somebody who is situationally depressed, I'm dying, versus somebody who suffers from major clinical depression and, has other ideations. So that's an important thing to know, too. And that you want to do that. You're going to, after you do all of that, you're going to have two witnesses that are going to attest to the voluntary nature of your individual request. And that's going to happen like 48 hours before you actually take the prescription. You're going to have two people sign and attest that this is voluntary on your part. Yes? Yeah, I'll tell you. And then you have to be able to take or ingest this yourself. But you can have somebody else prepare it. And so these are usually opiates. Sometimes they come in pill form. They have to be taken out of the capsules, dissolved in liquid. So a healthcare provider could do it. A hospice person could do it. Somebody can prepare it for you. But you're going to have to be able to drink it, digest it. And there's also some thinking about a feeding tube, and so that if you had a feeding tube, that if you could push that plunger down, that would be ingesting it yourself. So that might be another option, too, that you might have. Somebody was asking about the attestation. It has to be, it can't be your healthcare provider. It can only be one person who will benefit from your death, like somebody that you're trustee or on your will. So you're going to have a friend, somebody. That's why it's important to talk to your friends about this. You're going to have one uninvolved person that can be one of those witnesses for you at the end. So it can't be your hospice worker or your medical person. It could be one family member and a friend who is not going to benefit from your death. So that's important to know. There's a few other things that I just wanted to mention. What about insurances and annuities and people like that? Would this law have any effect on that, do you think, if you had a life insurance policy? No, this is not a suicide. So you don't have to worry about that. Any contract you have, any insurance policy, any annuities, is not going to be affected by a person choosing this aid in dying. Because aid in dying is not considered suicide or assisted suicide. So it is not that. And there will be a death certificate that's issued with the underlying disease. If you want to have the end of life option listed on your death certificate for some reason, you could do that, but you have to request that. Okay, so that's the major provisions of the law, and we have time for some questions in just a minute, but I wanted to go over a couple of things for you, and I think you wanted to do your announcement.
A quick minute to have a commercial break. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Regina Sneed, advocate for the California End of Life Option Act.
Okay, just a second. Before we open it for general questions and comments, I wanted to give you some homework. So I hope everybody is going to go talk to their doctor about this option and find out whether your doctor is going to participate or not, because this is all voluntary. Any person in that medical professional chain that's working on this, working in hospice, anybody would have the right to say, no, I don't want to be part of this process with you. So I've already asked my primary care doctor, and I had asked her kind of early, and her kind of general, I'm in Kaiser, so her general response was, oh, well, won't Kaiser just, you know, won't this be handled through the hospice doctors? So I had to explain to her that, no, that wasn't how the system was going to work. Now, Kaiser does have a system set up, and so if you're a Kaiser patient, you can find out what that system is. And then I asked my second doctor, and she says, oh, I'm absolutely supportive of this, of course. So she was on board and knew all about it. But that was like a couple months later. So you really need to find out right away whether, number one, your healthcare system is going to participate in this. And say Dignity Health, the Catholic hospital system here, they are not. Yeah, Dignity Health, the Catholic system. So in the 58 counties that we have in California, unfortunately, many of them have only Catholic hospital systems. So Compassion and Choices is working on its website to identify doctors all over the state who would be willing to write prescriptions and can do that for you. So you can look on there to find it. The Adventists, which is another religion, they just changed their policy after 20 years. They decided, and that change occurred for two reasons. Patients demanded it, but also some people in their provider network and people that work there said, we need to do this for our patients. So that was a brand new, I think that just happened last week. So advocacy in your own health system might help. And so all of you can do that, and that would be a good thing to do. Remember we talked about two doctors, that's actually 15 days apart. So if you're the person who will most likely use this is somebody who's dying of cancer or some kind of cancer that might go rapidly. So can you see why having all of this into place before you need it might really help? Because if you had to find two more doctors, maybe your doctor says no, you're going to have to find a new doctor. You know how long it takes to get an appointment. And if your Medicare is your primary coverage, there are a lot of doctors that don't see new Medicare patients. So this can be a real issue. So planning in advance is really, really, really important if you want to be in control of things. Let's take the microphone and take some questions.
I have two questions, but the first one right now is, the doctors, so can you say to your doctor that you want to do this even if you don't have a medical need for it at this moment so that it's in your record, or is that two times within 15 days?
Okay, that's when you actually have a diagnosis of 6 months to live. But right now is the time you need to find out from your doctors whether they agree with this. Are they going to participate? Would they write you a prescription? And remember I told you if you're on Medicaid, you can have a doctor's visit specifically just to talk about your end-of-life choices, this law and everything else. That means you can sit down with your doctor and talk about your advance directive, which I've done, and actually gone over the points in it. And so my doctor understands what those mean And everybody's advanced directors are a little different. I know Kaiser has really been encouraging their patients to use their forms and has been holding workshops. And that could be to an advantage because any large system like Kaiser, if the doctors have been trained on their advanced directive, the chances are when you check those boxes, they're going to know what it means or what the interpretation is. So that might not be such a bad thing to have a more standardized one. I happen to have one that's a very specific one that I drafted and went back and forth. A friend of mine was on the AIDS legal referral panel, and they created basically advanced directives for AIDS patients back in the 80s. And they actually have some pretty good models. So we actually went back and forth over wording about different parts. And I like that one because you have three options that are gradations of something, and you check the one that applies to you. And by not checking the other two, it's very clear that you didn't mean that and you didn't mean this. You meant this. So I really like that part of it. You had a second question.
Yeah, I know that there's been a legal challenge to this law, and so I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
I actually am not aware of a legal challenge. There was a thought about making a legal challenge to it. But that did not pan out, and I have not heard differently. But
maybe I misunderstood. I thought there was something, and they were trying to get the law stopped until they could file a legal challenge.
I'm pretty up to date. I haven't been told that that's the case. Right after the law passed, before the effective date on June 9th, there was an attempt to see if they could overturn the law through the repeal process, and that attempt failed. So they didn't do it. And I also have to mention that this law is sunsetted in 10 years. And that provision was put in there to get the law passed. And that was kind of a major concession. The other thing that really helped get the law passed was that the California Medical Association went neutral during the special session, and that allowed the law to pass. But there was, if you look at the provisions, the fact that you have to have a 48-hour attestation and have, all of these things are there as seen as protections, and you have to jump through some hoops to get where you want to go. So other questions or comments? Back in the back.
Cool. Is it on? Okay. My question is about capacity. So earlier you mentioned mental health issues for patients. There may be patients that do have a history of mental health issues, mm-hmm. and then they are diagnosed with a terminal illness. My question to you is there a requirement for a capacity evaluation to be done either by a neuropsychologist or a doctor to determine a person's capacity to make that decision?
Okay, that would be the mental health referral. If your doctor felt that you have to have two doctors that will write you the prescription. If neither one of them, if they know you well as a client, a patient, and they know of your history of past depression or something, and they make a determination that you're mentally competent to do that, they wouldn't necessarily have to make that mental health referral. But if they feel that they want to have that other professional opinion, they might do it. And if doing so it's in some systems, it takes a while to get that referral. So that's another reason why you want to have talked about all of this based on your own history before this kind of issue comes up to know how that might be addressed in your particular medical system. Each one might have something different. Now, I have heard, and I can't tell you which institution was leaning toward this way, but it might, I don't want to say because I'm not sure. And that's why it's very important to check. But one system was kind of leaning toward maybe trying to require that, which would mean like a third doctor. And I don't believe any system has actually adopted that policy. I think people would be lobbying against it for many reasons. But I can't say it strongly enough that early conversations, early understandings, and knowing what your system is. Say Medicare is a federal program, so it does not pay for the prescription. So if you're on Medicare, if you have a supplemental plan, you need to check with your supplemental plan to make sure that the cost of that prescription would be covered. And it can be expensive. It can be as much as $3,000. It could be $500 up to $3,000. It's you know, nobody kind of knows right now, and it depends on what they would use, you know, what would be prescribed for it. So you want to check, and we have open season coming up right in November for your supplemental plans. So now's a good time to, because those supplemental plans in California should have that information in them. So you need to check and see it in writing, what's in there. And if your system doesn't have it, you may want to switch if you need to. There's a question over here in the back. Let's get it on the tape.
Where do you get all the papers that you need?
Yeah.
I'm also a member of Kaiser. Is it through them?
Yeah, there's a couple places. Each medical system, there's in the law itself, there are forms. And so those forms have kind of been adopted. So each medical system can use those forms. If you want to see them, you can get them from the California Department of Public Health's website, which I think is in this brochure. Let me double check. Okay, I don't see it here, but that's probably... Oh, here it is. The State Department of Public Health has uploaded the forms on their website as of June 9th. And so I'm going to give you a copy. And so you can find that website, and you can actually look at all the forms that are needed. There's a form for everything. There's a form for the doctor to record your request. There are the forms for, you know, making the request for the prescriptions and all of that. And on the Compassion and Choices website, you can also find information about all of the different procedures. If your doctor needs information, there's a doc-to-doc hotline and information on the website specifically for doctors, for pharmacists. It's very comprehensive. So your doctor could phone and get information about any questions asked about it. And the same with pharmacists. Let's go up to the front here and over there.
I have two questions. The first is, you mentioned you can have on your death certificate that you've used this Life Option Act. What would be, is there any legal or personal or social
reason? It would be personal
reason?
Preference. I would rather have the cause of your underlying cause of death on my death certificate.
Okay. So
I don't see any particular reason to say that, but it's an option under the law.
Okay. My second question is, I remember the passage of the Oregon Act, and very few, at least in the early years, very few people used the option.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that once you go through all these steps, you don't need to really invoke the option. You can just have it available to you, and that would be the point.
And that's exactly what happened in Oregon. The reason over the 17, 18 years the Oregon law hasn't been in effect, because it was an early law that had passed, there wasn't a lot of publicity. And if you know anything about advertising, you've got to continually remind people that something's available. And so there's a chart, basically. So the law passed, and at the beginning it was up here, and then it went like down here. And then actually when California started working on this, there was an increase in Oregon of awareness of the Oregon law. So one of the things that Compassion and Choices is doing, and people like me going out to speak on it, is to raise awareness, to keep it in people's minds, and so that you know that it is an option. And that requires, it'll require constant vigilance or care to continue that. And after a while, you know, people see it and they don't pay any attention anymore. It's, you know, it's sort of like the ad you never see in the magazine you're reading. So it's important. This man has a question.
I carry this card in my wallet.
Which is?
As you know, it's the Willed Body Program.
Say the Willed Body.
Willed Body, yes.
Okay.
Donation to the University of California Medical Center.
Okay.
Right.
Did everybody understand what that is? Okay. If you wanted to donate your body to medical research, you can specify that and carry and let your doctor know. Et cetera. Now, they have certain requirements. That, you know, you have to meet certain requirements. They don't want everybody's bodies. So they don't want overweight people, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to make sure.
Is this affected by the legislation in any way?
No, it wouldn't be, except that your body would, depending on your underlying reason why you died and your overall weight and certain other things, it might. I think somebody might have some information in the back on this subject or another? Another one? Okay. Anyway, that's something that one can do. We had a question in the... We'll go
I
back
have a question.
To her.
After you gave that number of $3,000 possibly for the prescription, does California have a hemlock society?
The hemlock society still exists. Yeah.
Okay.
Does anybody know what, or does everybody know what the hemlock society is? If you don't, it's been around for a long time. Derek Humphreys wrote a book called Final Exit. And before we had this option that doesn't require you to die that way, there were procedures that one where one could take one's own death, but you actually had to involve another person, and that put that person at risk. So that is dangerous. Now, if, as we mentioned before, if you have a diagnosis of Alzheimer, you're not going to be able to use this prescription. So that... law that is out there, and it potentially might still be an option for some people. Yes, we have a question.
Is the Compassion and Choices website the place that you would recommend someone go if they are living out of state but have established residency in California?
Yes.
It is.
Yeah.
That's the best.
And then there are the other states, you know. Compassion and Choices, there's been an increase in interest in all over the country in other states in passing similar laws. So that is one of the things that Compassion and Choices works on, is to get these laws passed in other states.
So the doctor in another state can contact the doctors that are listed?
Oh, in terms of somebody, well, they didn't.
Yeah.
The person would have to get information?
To locate a doctor that's able to...
Oh, okay. Potentially, but if you go on the Compassion and Choices website, there is a place now where they're gathering information about providers and health systems that will honor this option. So I would start there. And I don't know if that's on the California Department of Public Health's website, but I'm not sure. Probably okay. Not. But Compassion and Choices is very interested in knowing if your doctor, for example, is writing prescriptions or willing to do that. They'd love to know who those doctors are so they could start getting, making that information available to the public. And so, we're just, June 9th wasn't that long ago.
Right. So what's the best resource for someone?
I think going to the website, and a doctor could call the doc-to-doc hotline right. That's listed on there is another doctor, okay. And ask for information.
Okay.
I think that would probably be the best for a doctor.
Are the insurance companies granting this request? Now, I know it's brand new, but when you said $3,000, do we know which insurance companies
well,
are?
That's what you have to find out. Is we know if you're in part of Dignity Health? No, the answer is
right,
no.
Right. None of
Kaiser's, yes. Kaiser's insurance would cover it. But everybody has different, I have a really good bells and whistle Kaiser plan, which Medicare is my first, it's a senior advantage or something. So Medicare is my first thing, but I have a very good former federal employee coverage, which would cover the prescription, no problem, for Kaiser, for example. But for each individual, each one of you, if you're, all of us mainly probably have Medicare as our primary and something as a secondary. So you need to find out from your secondary whether they cover this prescription, whether doctors will write it for you and stuff. Who knows what the cost is eventually going to be at some point, with all these medications. And if we had a national law, then Medicare could provide it. Yes.
I'm going to answer that question.
Would you
really
answer
quickly.
It better? Thank you.
So most health insurance companies are covering it. Unless they have an affiliation with a religious institution. So say, for example, Providence Health Plan as part of the Providence Health System wouldn't cover it. But your standard larger national and regional health plans like the Blue Cross Blue Shield, Anthem, United Healthcare, Kaiser, Aetna, those health plans do cover this. There are a couple of other sort of nuanced issues, though, that go into that, which is making sure you find out what your copay on that might be, and if there is a pharmacy that is or is not willing to dispense, because pharmacies are also able to make that decision. A couple of other fun things, because this is not hard enough for you to access. If you're in hospice, some hospices actually will deny that from you, because if you're on Medicare, then it actually rolls into how they are paid, and oftentimes they don't want to take on that payment. So if you do enroll in hospice, find out if your hospice agency is actually going to cover that. It's an interesting way that the law is written, in that every person along the way has to agree to this. So your insurance company, your primary care provider or your specialist, your hospice agency, they all have, and your pharmacy has to all approve, or you have to go out hunting again. Additional thing that we've started seeing is caregivers who are actually trying to act on behalf of their loved ones in enacting the End of Life Options Act. Just make sure, even if you are giving that information to your loved one who is taking care of you, you still have to voice that yourself as your choice, your option.
Yeah, that's true. You have to say it orally to your doctor, not to someone else. So you have to make sure that you've said that and get that request recorded. It's an oral request, but have them documented in your file. So I wanted to mention a couple of other things. There's several really great books and things. Did anybody happen to see the July 11th New Yorker? There's a wonderful, really long article written by a hospice nurse. That's just a really good sampling of all of the different types of situations that come up, and I really highly recommend it to you. And then we talked earlier about the one book, but there's another one that was written by a doctor called When Breath Becomes Air. Have you heard that one? He actually spoke, where did we see, was he here at Commonwealth Club? Yeah, that's right. Was that his wife spoke at the Commonwealth Club last month, I think it was. And then I have read a really wonderful book, which really chronicles, if you want a kind of a history of the whole movement and what went on in the other states. It's called The Good Death, An Exploration of Dying in America by Anne Newman. And it came out in 2016. And she just really goes through all of the different aspects of dying and goes to all of the states and interviews people, you know, where there's a law in effect. I found it very, very interesting and very useful to read. So somebody who came in early mentioned, like a cemetery plot. And so I actually got a questionnaire. I guess they get your mailing list or something. I've been getting them from Neptune Society lately. They've all, these have all come in the last 2 or 3 months, but this was from Cypress Lawn. And they sent me a questionnaire asking all sorts of information about funeral arrangements and what I wanted and whether my family knew about it. It's like 19 questions that they ask. Of course, they want to sell me a funeral plot, which I probably won't buy from them, but we'll see. So we're coming to close to the end. Are there any other comments that people would like to make? Another, we need a the microphone.
I just wanted to add to people's reading list that I think it was last year Katie Butler spoke very room about her book. I think it was Knocking on Heaven's Door, right. And also talked about a not so good death.
Yes, that's a very interesting one too. There's many, actually, there are books that are actually quite old from the 1980s. If you do a lit search, you will find some books that are really wonderful on this subject. I went and did a lit search at the library to see what the public library had and came up with 256 titles going back 30 years. So there's plenty of books on the subject.
I also think that in addition to having everything medically organized, that one should have all of their affairs pretty much spelled out, because your family may not know what's what or what's where.
Yes, tell them about your...
Oh, well, I have something that my children laughingly call my death folder. And in it is all the information they need, whether it's where there's a bank account or where my pension check comes from, who the Social Security phone number, because you have to let Social Security know, in addition to the fact that, of course, they get told by the funeral home. And, I mean, all of these things, if you have preferences as to your funeral, then you should have that all spelled out, what kind of funeral you want, where you want it, how you want it, you know, everything.
How many people have a death folder? A few people, good. And I have another question here, I think, right there.
It's not a question, but it's my mom just passed away, and our family was contentious, let's say, and I made her take pictures of all of the things that were of value to her and write in her handwriting on the back who it was going to go to and maybe the history of it or something. And so when she passed, I could just say, no, you can't have that. She wanted to give it to this person. And
that's wonderful.
So I found that very helpful as
Thank
the person
you.
Who was in charge of taking
Thank
care
Thank you
of her
for
stuff.
Sharing that. And I want to mention one other thing about sort of religious beliefs and stuff that can come into play. I will let you know now that I actually am a member of the bar, but I don't do trusts and wills and estate stuff. But because of that, over the years, I have been called to the hospital to mediate disputes between two siblings or family members about who's in charge with the advanced directive care, other kinds of issues. And that just happens to people. And it happens to me, I guess, because people talk to me about death. I don't know why they do. When they're dying, they talk to me about it. I don't know. Maybe I have a friendly listening quality or something, but it happens to me all the time. People talk to me. They tell me they're dying, and then we have a conversation about it, and I don't mind. But it really is important to make sure that your family members know all of your wishes, whether it's what you want to pass on that are important objects, what your religious beliefs are. Maybe you moved to California when you were young in the 60s, and maybe your religious beliefs aren't as similar to what you grew up, and you wouldn't want a certain kind of thing as part of your memorial or service or something to happen. So the more that you can communicate any aspect of this, the better off things will be. And many of you, I remember, says, I want to be in control. I want to know what to do. So do we now know what we need to do? Yeah? Who is going to do something by the end of next week? Anybody? What are you going to do? Just shout them out.
Oh, I have my list here.
Oh, let's hear. Can we hear? Where's the mic? She's right behind you.
Want to read my
list. You have a question. Go ahead with the question. Speak into the microphone.
The death book actually is a very good idea, and if there are only two of us that bother doing that, and the reason I say it is, as time goes by, if you're just going to do a lot of things verbally with people, they may go before you. And as you get older and older and people begin dying that are even younger, it has nothing even to do in many cases That's with correct. Age, all the things that you think you've told someone and they've agreed to take care of, they're not going to be around to do it. And boy, do I have experiences with that.
Okay, that was a very good comment. Now, we have a list, so maybe we can learn from the list.
You want to hear my list?
Absolutely.
Well, I need to talk to my best friend about my health care directive. I haven't done that. I need to finalize some accounts to go into the trust that I've already established. I need to finalize my health care directive. There are some changes I want to make. And I need to identify, I haven't identified my spiritual advisor. That was these are the things that you have mentioned that I haven't done yet. And I wanted to put healing touch on my end-of-life services.
Okay.
It's a modality that mm-hmm. nobody else but me would think about.
Excellent. Anybody want to contribute to something that they're going to do? Okay, go ahead. Another question.
If I have a tax problem, I could file my tax return myself. I seek an accountant. If I want to improve my body, I could go to the gym and get a trainer, or I could just walk in. Is there anybody in the capacity of someone as a consultant, perhaps, not particularly a medical person, but can assemble all this information, which can just to make sure that it's up to date, by spending time with me or whoever it is, and put it all together?
Sounds like a new profession. Somebody has a comment back there. I'm going to see what you have to say about it. I think that you could get a... sometimes that person is an attorney that's helped you with certain things. It might be a friend who's done this already. I'm not sure, but let's see what she has to say.
So the American Bar Association right now is starting to train financial planners in a new certification, which is focusing on end-of-life affairs and end-of-life planning that doesn't necessarily just stop with the fiduciary pieces of end-of-life. And so they're forming these medical legal partnerships. So if you're looking for a financial planner, they should actually be advertising that they have additional training in advanced care planning or in the development of advanced directives.
That's helpful to know. And I want to mention something else that came up in another presentation. A gentleman came up and asked me, he says, you know, I have no children. I'm divorced. I have all my friends. I don't want to be a burden on anybody, but I want to set up my financial situation so that if I become incapacitated, I'll have somebody making those decisions. So I did a little research about private fiduciaries. And, you know, you can go to a bank, a trust, your broker, all these different people could provide this service to you, and they're licensed to. Because they're licensed, they can do it. But there's now a group of people that are kind of quasi-professional, and they become licensed. And they're private fiduciaries. And so you would pay them a fee of a certain percentage of your assets, and they could handle bill paying, taxes, that kind of thing. Some of us, if you have a trust with a bank, for example, you might have your financial things taken care of by a bank trust officer, usually an attorney. This all costs money, unfortunately. You will be charged fees for it. But more and more, I mean, more than one person came up to me, and this happened to be a presentation at FROM, which is the senior university, some of you know. It hadn't occurred to me that, you know, people would be in a situation maybe where they didn't have somebody that they were afraid of how that part, the financial stuff, would be handled. So I'm really happy to hear about the ABA's stepping up on this, because I really do think it's time for that. And I think it's time for us to close. I want to thank all of you very much. I hope that I've met most of your expectations. If you have any other questions, please come see me after.
Our thanks to our speaker, Regina Sneed, for her comments here today. We also want to thank the audience here, as well as those listening in the recording to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 114th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.